Duck, duck, goose! The Duck of Minerva in stereo.
Welcome to episode 15 of the Duck of Minerva podcast. In this podcast, I interview Barry Buzan about his academic biography, his intellectual views, and his scholarly works. I do have to apologize in advance, though. The audio quality in this recording is much poorer than I would like. You will hear sirens, you will hear brakes screeching, cars driving by, and the hustle and bustle of life in London. Why is this? The best I can tell, London is a very loud city, and the walls of this particular administrative building at the London School of Economics, well, they're rather thin. Hope you enjoy. Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and I am coming to you from the London School of Economics, where I have corralled Barry Buzan, and he has kindly agreed to do one of these podcasts. Hi, Barry.
Hi, Dan.
So we were talking right before we started about your illustrious career, but particularly a misconception, because I said, I was sort of saying, well, you could talk about your background because you're a Canadian, right? And you said, no. And I said, you're an American? You said, no, common misconception. And I said, well, what's with the accent? So maybe you can explain a bit.
Okay, I'm the man with no home accent. So wherever I go, people think I'm from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And that's broadly speaking true. I was born in London just after the war. For a variety of reasons, my family emigrated to Canada in 1954. So when I was eight, so I grew up in Canada, and then I emigrated back to London in the late 1960s, and shortly thereafter acquired an American wife. So my accent is a kind of mid-Atlantic composite. So is that of my wife, as a matter of fact.
But not mid-Atlantic in terms of Virginia, but mid-Atlantic as in the middle of the Atlantic.
The middle of the Atlantic, yeah. So my citizenship is British, although I can also fly a Canadian flag, because I picked that up along the way.
So you've had you're still extremely productive, and I hope that we can talk about the 19th Century Project and some of the other stuff that you're working on now. But you've had a very long and illustrious career in which you've really, you know, founded a number of different research areas, or been at least instrumental in advancing a number of those research areas. So I think it's probably best to sort of, for us to go back and for you to talk about your career trajectory, particularly for younger listeners who may only know you through some of the late work.
Okay. I drifted into international relations, really. In school, I was interested in history in school, but it was Canadian history, which was pretty boring because nothing really happened in Canada, and I liked, you know, wars and all that kind of stuff, having those kind of boyish interests. So I did science in school, and I still keep up with that a little bit. When I got to university, happily, the North American four-year system allows you to drift for at least a year and try various things out, which I did. Discovered I had no talent for mathematics whatsoever, and therefore science was a dead end. History got more interesting. And in my second year, this is University of British Columbia, I was lucky enough to encounter Cal Holstein, who at that point must have been just about finished with the first edition of his textbook. And this book was developed off his course that he was teaching, the Introduction to IR. I took that course, therefore, when it was perfect. And it just blew me away. So I was lucky enough to encounter a great teacher at the point where I needed to make up my mind, and that's how I got into IR.
So after completing your undergraduate degree, you got your doctorate at?
Yes, after completing my undergraduate degree, I rather foolishly agreed to stay on at UBC because they offered me money, and this was a mistake. I think you should never take a master's degree in the same place you took your undergraduate degree, because it's the same old people saying the same old things in a very slightly different way. So I got bored. And one of my dirty little career secrets is that I never finished my master's degree. I dropped out and went traveling for a year. And then I fetched up at the LSE to do my doctorate. Fortunately, I had a very good first-class honors undergraduate degree, so the missing master's degree didn't matter. It didn't matter as much in those days anyway, and it certainly didn't matter much in the UK. So I went then straight into the PhD here. Basically, by this time, realizing I wasn't really much good at anything else, but I seemed to be good at this, and people kept offering me money for it, so I kept taking it. And that's what ended me up doing my PhD here and then carrying on into an academic career. Not at all clear to me what else I might have done in life.
So can you tell us a little bit about what your early work was about?
My interest was war and military and strategic studies. Boyish interests were what kind of got me into this. My PhD was on the peace movement, because I grew up in the 60s. There were lots of peace movements around. To my undying shame, no doubt, I didn't join any of them because they all seemed to me to be a bit fruitless, other than making a moral statement. Their position taking didn't seem to me to be very functional. So my interest at that time was to try to understand why peace movements didn't work. And I was going to do a big comparative study across periods between Britain and the US. But when I came to do it, my first case was the British peace movement between the wars, and absolutely nothing had been written on that. So I ended up doing, since I wasn't a historian, and my supervisor didn't really point that out and make the necessary steering moves, I ended up doing a passable but not really very wonderful PhD, which involved a lot of primary research on the British peace movement, and answered my question.
And what was your answer?
My answer was, it's a varied answer. I never published it as a book, but basically they were trying to influence foreign policy decisions in ways that would never be acceptable to governments, if governments actually accepted that kind of pressure. I mean, it just wasn't going to happen, basically. And then, of course, they were wildly divided amongst themselves, which enabled governments to play them off against each other. In the case I looked at, you had kind of fairly orthodox internationalist League of Nations type people, and then pacifists. And the pacifists were really trying to force the government's hand by direct action of one sort or another. None of these things seemed ever likely to work to create the sort of policy changes that they wanted. And quite a lot of it was pretty naive as well. There was a kind of general assumption that the more people got in touch with each other, the better international relations would be, which is a quite dubious proposition. There was also quite a lot of politics involved. Obviously, the more left-wing, radical, pacifist-type peace movements were associated more with the Labour Party, and the other stuff was associated more with the Liberals and up to a point the Conservatives. So it was very politically divisive as well.
And I don't have your... I did not do due diligence, because I was running around trying to get a SIM card to work this morning, and so I did not take a look at your CV. So I'm really at this point, you know, going to have you walk through. But
okay.
So, have you now? I know that, you know, when a sort of my awareness of your work comes in the picture, you were associated with Copenhagen as well as some other institutions. But where did you start out working? I mean, what did the trajectory look like, and how does this line up with the various work that you were doing?
Okay. After the PhD, I'd done with the peace movement, wasn't interested in that anymore. Was still a little bit bored with strategic studies, which was at a kind of heading for a dead end at that time, intellectually. Mark Zacher invited me back to UBC for a postdoc, provided I could make myself interested in the law of the sea, about which I knew absolutely nothing. But it was a good offer. I had reasons for wanting to go back to Vancouver for a couple of years, so There was never a sense in which I was going to go back to Canada and stay there. But for a couple of years, it was a good idea. It was a useful job. And so I got myself interested in the law of the sea and attended the conferences and wrote some things around that. And that was the basis of my work from most of the 70s into the early 80s.
Can I ask you a question? Because 2 weeks ago we had Nagonoff on, and he was talking about doing international law in the United States in the late 60s, early 70s. And the way he described it was that it was absolutely marginal, that he was working in a public policy school, that the theorists who ruled the roost in the United States, who he described as realists, didn't have any use for this international legal stuff. But you were doing international law in Canada. Did you have a different experience?
I wasn't really doing international law. I was doing the politics of the law of the sea. Okay. So I was looking at the negotiations and that kind of stuff. It was all new material to me. And I got interested in a couple of aspects of it. I got interested in the process of negotiating by consensus, which was emerging then in the back rooms of the Law of the Sea Conference. And so I wrote a paper on that, which in fact was roundly rejected as being completely useless by IO and given the annual prize by the American Journal of International Law, which taught me quite a lot about the variability of responses from journals to the same piece of work. I wasn't really doing international law, and I think what you say broadly applied in Canada as well, that realism was the mainstream. At that time, I suppose the other emergent dynamic in IR was behavioralism, and that divided departments, as you know, it still does to some extent, but at that point, that kind of traditionalist behavioralist thing was quite big in the air.
Quite big in the...
In the air, yeah. Those were the kinds of things going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I finished with all that, I came back to the UK and picked up a job at the University of Warwick, happily, although unfortunately rather briefly. Fred Hirsch was the head of department there, so this taught me that I needed to know more about political economy than I did before, and I learned a lot from him. But the imperatives of teaching pushed me back towards security studies, basically. That was what people wanted to know, and I still found that entertaining to do. So that was what, in a sense, led to People, States, and Fear, which was a book I wrote during the late 70s, early 80s, and which was a strange book in the sense that I didn't set out to write that book. I set out to write a kind of introduction to strategic studies. Thought that, well, really, since security seems to be the main concept here, I better have a chapter talking about the concept of security. And as I got into that chapter, it took on a life of its own and became that book. And that book largely defined the rest of my career. Everything I have done since then was raised in one way or another pretty explicitly in that book. So I'm in the slightly strange position at the moment of some 30-something guy who was using my name set out everything that I've done ever since.
Well, as we mentioned before we started recording, People, States, and Fear was the first full-length IR textbook I ever read, and for a security studies class as an undergraduate, both as a kind of introduction to anarchy and all that, but also as a framework piece to think about different dimensions of security. So I can see, and if you think about, I see what you're saying, because, I was thinking as you were saying that, well, securitization was there, sort of the work you did in structural realism was there, there was English school society type work. There was stuff on political change, so I can definitely see that. But you were saying also that you felt like the book didn't get the kind of traction that you wanted or were expecting. Right?
Oh, it did. Mm. It just didn't in the U.S.
Okay.
I mean, the U.S., well, I'm going to be rude now, so forgive me, American audience.
No, but this is exactly the kind of thing that I actually would really like to hear about, right, is differences between the continental divide. And
from an outsider's perspective, yeah. The U.S. is... intellectually the most parochial market in the universe. It's very, very difficult to break into the U.S. from outside. So as far as I'm aware, People's State Sincere, it registered with a few individuals in the U.S., but was not widely used and didn't sell very well there.
But that's not the case then in Britain.
Well, in the rest of the world, it did different things in different places. Happily, it took me all around the world to find out. In Scandinavia, it happened to resonate quite strongly, and also in a similar way in Japan, because people were getting bored with the kind of peace research versus strategic studies head-knocking game. And that book opened up a middle ground where the willing parties from both sides could actually meet there and talk to each other and have recognize the common language, the common interests that they in fact often shared. So it hit the zeitgeist right in some places because of that. In other places, it was received in very peculiar ways. My favorite story, although I tell it against myself in a way, is that it was very popular with the Bureau of State Security in South Africa during apartheid days. They loved it because it challenged their thinking, because it said South Africa is a weak state. And they, of course, all thought of South Africa as a strong state. So they actually designed their induction course for new possible members of BOSS around this book.
You can't see, but my eyes are kind of widening in this look right now.
The basic test was you studied this book for a week pretty intensively, and then you had to sit a test on it. And what they were looking for was to differentiate between those who warm to the book because it didn't actually answer any questions but made them think harder about all of them, and those who hated it because it didn't answer any questions, who were looking for a more kind of business school approach which would be problem solving. Those people, the latter, the ones who wanted their questions answered, they threw out. They took the ones who found it challenging because it improved their level of thinking. So I had to be pleased with that on the one hand,
but horrified on the other.
Not too pleased on the other.
Well, I remember my advisor Chuck Tilley talking about being horrified to learn that at the Central Intelligence Agency they were using some of his stuff because he was an old lefty. But
I think this is one of the truths about academic life that books and articles are a little bit like children in some ways. You give birth to them and then they go off and you don't. You don't have any control over what kind of lives they then lead, and people will read them in different ways and for different purposes, and you have no control over that. And you might like some of it, you might be stimulated by some of it, and you might hate some of it and think, "No, that's not what I meant." But you put your product out there, and the world deals with it in a variety of different ways, and that's just part of the game.
So People, States, and Fear was an enormous hit everywhere but the United States.
It didn't go quite that far, but it was a pretty big hit in a lot of places.
By academic standards, right?
Academic standards, right. Yeah. It's still my best-selling book.
And is it still in print in some edition, I guess, I would imagine?
Yeah. I did a second edition in 90... the first edition was 83. The second edition was 91. So
the second edition is the one that I must have read.
The second edition is the one that with the gut spread all over the place. Although, having said mean things about the U.S., I'll now say something nice. The USIA, I don't know whether that's still in business, but the then...
No, it's out of business.
The then sort of soft arm of American foreign policy for making friends and influencing people... bought the rights to People, States, and Fear for reasons that are still a complete mystery to me, but they bought the rights to publish their own edition of it through some presumably press that they own called TransAsia Publishers, and they then, part of their game was to give away piles of books to people they wanted to make friends with or influence. And I guess they use People, States, and Fear to leaven the loaf of this. I can't imagine that they saw anything that was particularly advantageous to them in it, substantively. But anyway, they distributed these copies free all over South Asia and the Middle East and parts of Africa. And that, of course, stimulated lots of pirate editions, and so it got distributed all over the place, much more widely than might otherwise have been the case because of that move. Then there's no third edition, because then the Copenhagen School stuff came on and took things in a different direction. But I did write, there's a new issue of it by ECPR Press from 2007, to which I wrote a new introduction explaining the history of it and what I still agree with, what I don't, why it wasn't revised again, what things I think worked, what things I was unhappy didn't get taken up, and what did, and how it relates to the Copenhagen School stuff that came after. So anybody who's interested in that can look at that 2007 edition and pick up that that essay.
So we've already hit on the, shall we say, what you call American parochialism, what others would call the transatlantic divide, and I guess the trans-Pacific divide and the trans-hemispheric divide. But another schism that you mentioned that I think is deep in the DNA of contemporary IR, but isn't really well known, if at all, by people like me, you know, sort of my generation onward, or is known only in the vaguest sense, is the peace studies, strategic studies schism that you mentioned. Mm. And I thought you might be able to enlighten us a little bit about what that was about. I mean,
yeah, the book that Lena Hansen and I did in 2009 on the evolution of international security studies tells that story in quite a lot of detail. And it's a curious story in some ways, because the peace researchers were more in the mold of proper behavioralism than the strategic studies people, and you'd think it would be the other way around. But all the quants and such like were on the peace research side. They shared a lot of agenda with strategic studies in some ways. I mean, they were interested, both sides were interested in arms racing and arms control and all of that. They obviously had different normative perspectives, and so ended up shouting past each other quite a lot. And the there were a lot of accusations. The peace researchers would accuse the strategic studies people of basically just being there to justify and vindicate deterrence policies. And a lot of them found mutually assured destruction morally unacceptable. And on the other, the other way around, the strategic studies people, mainly more on the right, would accuse the peace researchers of being fellow travelers for the Soviet Union, undermining military policy by creating peace movements and all of that sort of stuff. So there was, in a sense, a divide between the activist wing of the peace researchers and the more kind of status quo wing of strategic studies. But of course, they were also activists in the sense that they were selling their stuff to the state, a lot of them. And so there was some truth, I think, in the peace research charges that these guys were complicit in policy. And in that sense, you know, they were both not academically neutral positions. Both of them were doing some properly academic work and a real analysis, but both of them were also engaged in political games, whether they admitted it or not. So there was some real grounds for tension between them. But all of this was kind of coming apart at the seams by the time we get into the later 80s. And really, you know, there was a desire. The discourse was changing. The nuclear deterrent stuff was becoming less prominent, less interesting, less threatening in a way as the Cold War was ending. And the new security agenda that was emerging at that time was clearly something that both of them were interested in. So I think then a lot of people moved into the middle ground, really, and that the heat went out of that debate, although the same kinds of political positions are still there.
So people, states, and fear was where we had kind of wound up. And my memory, which is through the prism of 20 some years, is that it's not is that it's not an easy book to sum up, right? That there are a lot of arguments going on there, but broadly speaking, a kind of framework for thinking about different dimensions of security, putting state-society relations back into security, for example, a whole bunch of other things. But that, as I said, is sort of a fuzzy memory. You know, I've gone back to it a couple times, particularly for the section you have on anarchy. But is there a quick way you could kind of sum it up for listeners, or is that just impossible?
I think it's probably impossible because partly because people take very different things out of it. That's always been my experience of it. You know, that some people took the regions and stuff out of it, and some people took the sort of security debates, and some people took the definition of the state. All kinds of different things appealed to different people at different times. It was a strange book in the sense, as I say, I didn't design it like that. I just started trying to write an introductory chapter and then had to follow my nose where the story seemed to go. And it needed to wander through all kinds of different disciplines because that's really what security was about. I mean, we were, by the time I was thinking about this, in mainly late 70s, early 80s, the security agenda was beginning to change. And so it wasn't just about nuclear deterrence anymore. There was elements of environmental security were coming in, elements of economic security were coming in from the oil crisis and such like. So all of that stuff was in the air. And I just happened to be the place where that story all came together in the same place at the same time. So it was the first book that took on the concept of security in and of itself and just thought about it as a concept. Now, you could find any number of academic books to do that for power and other sorts of stuff, but nobody had done it for security. And I just kind of wandered into that almost by accident. And that's how that book happened and why it took the form that it did. It was lucky timing for me in that some of the ground underneath Cold War security studies was already beginning to shift, and I was sensitive to that because that was the time I was growing up, so that was the sort of things that were in the air then. And it seemed I put it together into a package that was attractive in many places. And in fact, I mean, that was also to link to the next part of the story, it was people, states, and fear that got me to Copenhagen, because the Danes and other Scandinavians loved the book. And I didn't know that until I was invited to Denmark and suddenly found myself surrounded by people who'd read the book. and that's how I met Ola and how the Copenhagen School thing got rolling.
So is the Copenhagen, my timeline here is fuzzy. The Copenhagen School stuff predates structural realism, is coterminous with it, or happens afterwards?
It happens alongside. I tend to work on several things at once. I like doing that. Partly in case I get stuck or bored with something, I can just leave it aside and let it stew in the back rooms of my mind and go and do something else. Partly because I drifted into co-authoring a lot, which I like to do. And I may even be some kind of record holder in terms of the number of people I've co-authored with, I don't know.
We're going to have to use you as a, who's the mathematician who you have a number of removal from?
Oh, the 6 degrees of separation?
No, it's actually, this is embarrassing, but it's like a, it's Hungarian academic who, I believe Hungarian, who co-authored with a bunch of people, and now a big thing is what your number is, which is how many. And I can't believe I'm blanking
okay.
on this.
I don't know.
So it's one of those things that sound...
I can't rescue you there.
But we can do something like that with you, probably.
But you could. Let me know how it works out. So co-authoring also means that you sit around waiting quite a lot of the time. I write much faster than most people. Just happen to be able to do that, which was lucky, which means if I'm in a writing
Erdos. It's your Erdos number. I'm sorry. That's going to bother me.
I mean, I often found myself waiting for somebody else to deliver their bit. So that led me to a kind of multi-tracking approach to things. And that's how I got into doing these things at the same time. So the Copenhagen connection came about in the late 80s and was really rolling by 1990 because they offered me a kind of project director position there. So I became a kind of absentee landlord for that research project at what was then called COPRI, the Copenhagen Peace Research Institute. So I used to go over to Copenhagen once every 6 or 7 weeks for a few days, and we'd have intensive seminars around whatever project we were working on and whatever other things people wanted to present. And that that was fabulous. That was a very high time during my career. Those seminars were wonderful. Everybody learned a lot. Some people fled, unable to take the heat. But those who stayed learned a lot, I think, and I learned a lot too. So, and it was out of that process that the so-called Copenhagen School came about.
Well, we have two trajectories then we can go on. Do you want to talk about the Copenhagen School substantively? And we have so there was this rich intellectual stew going on, mm-hmm. and that had, and it sounds like it had connected up. People had read your work. It was sparking their ideas in Scandinavia, in Denmark, at COPRI in particular. And that then produces what is the sort of intellectual development and products that are coming out of that?
Okay, well, let's first deal with what went in the sense that the core of it was me and Ole Weber. Mm-hmm. And we came from completely different backgrounds. I mean, he seemed to have read everything that I'd read, plus 150 other things. But we had common roots in realism. Kissinger was a great god of his. And he'd read my stuff and liked the kind of taking off with the idea of security. So we had some common bases. He also, like a lot of the other Scandinavians, was attracted by the regional side of the thinking in people's days. Regional security complexes was a big hit for them for reasons I'm not all that clear about, but it was. So we kind of started putting our heads together and initially to run this rather odd absentee landlord type project, the best thing to do seemed to be to do books together. So the first one we did was on the end of the Cold War, and that kind of produced writing partnerships because I was working with whoever was on the team there, but Ola and I were at the core of it in terms of ideas. I mean, he styles himself as a postmodern realist. Get your head around that, you can understand where he's coming from. But he was at that point in the late, well, it must have been the late 80s, early 90s, he was beginning to develop the securitization thinking. That side of it is his, not mine at all. I kind of bought into it because once he could explain it to me in terms I could understand, it seemed to me to be a very good idea and a way to go forward. I bought in the levels and sectors side of things, and I bought in the regional security side of things. So the Copenhagen School was a kind of mixture of all of these things. Like all schools, including the English school, it seems to have been given its name by somebody calling for its closure or trying to damn it. So there's a nice warning there. If you want to damn something, don't label it, because the label will live, but your critique will disappear into history. And that's true of the English school as well. So we acquired a label, ran with it. The partnership was very successful and very fruitful for more than a decade. So we did the securitization stuff. We did the regional stuff, and the levels and sector stuff was kind of run through that. COPRI provided a very nice environment. There were always people who came and went for 2-3 years here and there, people like Jaap de Wild and Thomas Dietz and others, Stefano Guzzini. So there were lots of interesting people who circulated through for a while and participated or not for a while, and made their input to it, in just depending on whatever was going on at the time. But you know, we worked out pretty much all of the agenda. When it came to an end, I kind of turned the securitization stuff back to Ola because it was his stuff. We had had the usual difficulty that because I was the senior of the two of us, I got a lot more credit for securitization than I should have. I mean, he did 95% of that. I helped him out with it, and I threw in one or two ideas, but not more than that. And he did the same for me with the regional security complex. That so did that in the 2003 book. So we eventually worked out pretty much our whole agenda by the time COPRI was rather tragically and stupidly shut down.
That was a political issue, right?
Yeah. I think. That was to do with some of the more arcane aspects of Danish politics, which I won't bore you with.
Well, I remember talking to Stefano when that was going on, right? I mean, it was Prime Minister didn't, or some minister didn't like COPRI, right? COPRI.
I mean, the short version of the story is that COPRI had been set up by a coalition of opposition parties against a more right-wing party when it was in government. And they passed the bill for it. It required a bill, which they passed over the government's head. And the party that was the government never forgave them for that and promised that if they ever had the opportunity to shut it down, they would. And come 2001, they did, and they did. So it was, you know, political small-mindedness of a high order, because by that time, COPRI had been astonishingly successful. It had a worldwide reputation, so the Danish taxpayers' money had been very well used there, in the sense that they had created a world-renowned center for security studies, which was then just thrown away.
Now, you also have a series of work, and I've mentioned this, the structural realism volume. There's a follow-up volume that was just you and Richard Little, right, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And that stuff, in my mind, was always related to the resurrection of the English school, but I'm not sure that's right. I mean, that's not mentioned in the first book, but by the time we get to the sort of extension book, right, you're bringing in quite consciously ideas from the English school about variation in the structure of international society.
Yes. I mean, in my training, I had never heard of the English school. I mean, I knew who Hedley Bull was, but the term English school never crossed my my mind. Even, I think, when I was writing the second edition of People, States, and Fear, I might even then not have recognized English school, although I understood that there was a literature out there on international society. So I picked up the English school stuff in the 1990s.
Okay.
Partly, I mean, Waltz was the big name. In fact, it was, I mentioned the course that I took with Cal Holstey as being what kind of tipped me into IR. And it was very specifically, and I remember the moment very clearly, when Holstey gave his talk on polarity theory. This would have been in 1965, something like that. So he was talking Waltz, basically. And that just blew me away. I have always been vulnerable to the kind of high-altitude, big-picture, grand simplification stuff. And the way he presented that as a way of looking at the complexities of history, but simplifying it down to this kind of very raw thing, I just thought, wow. So like many others, I was somewhat enthralled to Waltz. It was what I was trained with. It was he was the big name of the day. I was it fitted with my kind of mental inclinations to think in that way. So an engagement with Waltz has been a long-term factor in my thinking, and Olivier was fine with that. I mean, we both bounced off Waltz and realism in the same way. But thinking of it, and I think he and I probably shared this, we thought of realism as a great place to start, but a really miserable place to finish. So it was the kind of core from which you worked out. And that's, in a sense, what led to the book with Charles Jones and Richard Little, the Logic of Anarchy book. And that, in turn, led to the book I did with Richard, which then moves more into a world historical direction. The training I had as the IR degree at UBC when I was doing it back in the 60s was a joint degree in history and politics, IR, but half and half history and politics. So that history side has always been there for me. Oddly, given my Waltzian inclinations to high abstraction. So the two things were always there, and the things were beginning to point in an English school direction for me in the early 90s. Ola was also interested in that stuff. He knew the work of Manning very well, which I did not. So he was also part of my introduction to that. So that was clearly by 1993 in the IO article. I knew what the English school was and was putting it together with the other theoretical packages. So that became another strand of my work, and it fed into, although didn't then dominate, the work with Richard Little on international systems in world history. But by the time we'd finished that book, both of us were thinking, well, this ends us up squarely in English school territory, so basically that's what we should be doing now, and that's what I've been basically doing since then. I've slowly moved away from the security stuff, figuring I've made a couple of good contributions there, and I'm not sure that I have anything else that I want to say. Whereas I think I can actually do quite a bit on this English school stuff, and at the moment that takes my interest more.
Is it wrong? My knowledge of the English school is not what it should be, but I mean, we can say that about a lot of things in our life. Is it wrong that some of the ways you formulated, my understanding is that some of the ways you formulated the analytics of the English school are now how we kind of think about English school work? Is that
right? I'm way off on one side of the English school. But I'm, because my interest, and here we're kind of a little bit back to the Waltzian roots again, I like the structural mode of thinking. Mm-hmm. I like grand narratives. I like big picture, high altitude stuff. And I like the challenge of being a generalist in a field of specialists. So I'm not a specialist in anything, but I know something about almost everything. And so the game I play in the profession, as it were, is seeing if I can find a comparative advantage in providing overviews. And to the extent that I can, you have therefore to withstand a certain amount of specialist sniping from the wings, because you're always going to be wrong about some detail if you're not a real expert on things. But the real experts on things are experts in fairly narrow ways, and if you can give them and put them into context in some way, that's good added value. And that's what I've made my career trying to do, because it fits with my inclinations to do that, and I suppose fits with such talents as I have in the field.
So when you say that all of your work now is sort of in the English school idiom, you're talking about work about more comparative historical, sort of systemic and systemic change kinds of work. You're talking about the work you've done with people, including Matthias Albert, on differentiation. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of what is the universe of work now that you would say is kind of in, and how is it in the English school?
It's mainly in and around the English school. I'm just finishing off now a book which is a kind of introduction to the English school. It's not a kind of basic introduction, so yeah. I hope even those who think they know quite a bit about the English school will learn something. So that, in a sense, is one of my core projects. The 19th century project with George is not specifically English school, and represents the fact that I suppose I'm a bit of a magpie, and because I like working with other people, because it enables me to do things I wouldn't otherwise have time to do by myself, and it's very stimulating. I am, up to a point, open to suggestion about what to do. Matthias came along and said, you know, he'd picked up on the sector stuff in particular, because he thought that sounds a lot like functional differentiation, and he was much more knowledgeable about that. So he gave me a kind of short course in sociological thinking, and I read a lot of stuff that I wouldn't otherwise have read. So we danced around this idea of, because I'd always been concerned about the lack of a theoretical foundation for sectors. Empirical existence is clear enough, but exactly what they are and whether there's a limit to the set or how they're derived, that kind of thing, that's much tougher. And I had hoped that maybe the functional differentiation side of things would provide a pathway in there. I actually don't think it does. But it was a very interesting excursion to find that out.
So by sectors, you mean the development of things like an economic sector, a military sector, or even subsectors
just
within
the way,
that?
The way that the academy divides itself up into subjects. Part of that comes out of the kind of revolutions of modernity and the separation of economics and politics and all of that. But you know, we separate these things out and treat them as something, something separatable, something distinctive, something about which you can theorize, without really knowing what the principles are. It just happens. So if you look at the intellectual history of why we have the disciplines we do, it's not because it makes some kind of fundamental sense and some big high-powered committee sat down at some point and said, well, you know, this is the way it divides up, guys. It's all been about turf wars and other things. So the sectors thing is analytically quite powerful, I think, but it's not well theorized and still isn't. I don't think I'm going to find the answer to that, but it's totally embedded. I mean, we feel completely waltz. It's a theory of international politics, and he says, you know, this is all I can do. I can't do a wider theory than that. But he's already accepted a sectoral or functional division thereby, by simply assuming that you can talk about politics by itself. Why is that? How do we do that? We do it empirically, and it's ubiquitous. But you know, if you look at the amount of discussion there's been about levels of analysis and what they mean, it's a curiosity that there hasn't been a similar discussion about sectors, because sectors are just as ubiquitous. And in a multi-sector field like IR, that would be the obvious place to do it. You could quite understand how political scientists and economists and sociologists, being locked into their sector, wouldn't see beyond it. But IR should be a better location for doing that.
Or would be oriented towards colonizing a sector with their methods or modes of understanding. So
yeah, sectors are comfortable.
Right. So the sectoral stuff, Luhmann, that was interesting, but that's not really sort of fundamentally where you're headed now, then. Is that the...
Well, fundamentally where I'm headed now is the grave. I'm getting older, and I'm quite conscious of the fact that, indeed, it was why I took retirement when I did. My working hypothesis is that with a reasonable amount of luck, I will have 10 good writing years left in me. I don't see too many people who are writing tip-top stuff or a lot past their mid-70s. There are a few, but very few. So whatever I want to say or do, I need to be getting on with it. And that's one of the reasons why I've been narrowing in more and more on the English school stuff, because I think I can still make some useful contributions there. When I happened to cross paths with George Lawson at the LSE, we quickly discovered we had a common interest in the 19th century, which had been a long-standing fascination of mine. He knew a lot more about it than I did. my work with Matthias Albert provided me with enough of the sociological background to be able to link in with what George was doing and his way of thinking. And we decided it would be a fun thing to do to try to reintroduce IR to the 19th century, because the 19th century isn't there in IR. You jump from 1648 to 1919 with more or less nothing in between the bulk of IR.
Well, I mean, I think as you say in the article, which I've read since I was asked to respond to it, which was an interesting experience because I primarily agree with the thrust of the argument about, you know, when really important changes happen and that they're rooted in that period of time. But, you know, it is true that we mine the 19th century. I mean, most of our theories of power politics are extrapolations off of the behavior of 19th century European states, usually ignoring the fact that those are the centers of empires, you know, and other sorts of things. So, I mean, I think that just if our listeners seem puzzled, what I take you by meaning by saying we ignore the 19th century is we ignore the 19th century as a crucial inflection point, as a place in which the modernity is constituted, is made, and to which we're still living in the downstream implications of, as opposed to, so it's not that we don't study the 19th century, because we do a lot, it's just that we don't think about it as a transformational era.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas other disciplines, world history, sociology, historical sociology, Marxism, do. And I think they're right to do that. So what George and I are trying to show in the book we're doing is exactly how much of the agenda of contemporary IR has its roots in the 19th century, and not before. I mean, there's a little bit that comes before, but not very much. And this gives you quite a different sense of what we should be thinking about and how we should be understanding where we are now, what, you know, what we're living downstream of, as it were. But, you know, there are no, I guess George and I also did this Benchmarks article, I don't know if you've seen that, it's just out online for EJIR.
Yeah, I took a look at it.
But, you know, that, the argument there is IR sets up these benchmarks by which it divides up the subject for teaching and research, and the 19th century isn't there at all, even though it can be argued that it's the biggest transformation of all in recent times, and the one that's most significant for what most of us are actually thinking about. So that's just tremendous good fun to do, and it's good to do it with somebody who comes from a slightly different disciplinary background. Again, I find those synergies very stimulating, very entertaining, and it's good work to do. It ties in with some of the English school work.
That's what I was going to say, because I was puzzled. Because I was puzzled when you said that it wasn't part of the broader English school argument, and so I'm going to push you now to talk maybe a little bit about why you don't see it as really being embedded in your English school work.
I mean, it runs in parallel with the English school work, and there are lots of connections across, but it's not framed as an English school work. It's not about, or not primarily about, the institutions of international society or world society. It feeds into all of those things, but it's not framed in that way. And it's
so it's an
animal. Not really trying to prove any English school points. It's basically aimed at IR as a whole. So it's aimed at everybody, showing them how what they think they're thinking about actually has its roots where they haven't thought about it. And that this matters in all kinds of ways.
So let's go back to the English school side of things, because you know, you had said that you have a very different perspective. You describe yourself as being out there,
yeah,
right, with the hand motions on the English school. That you and you describe that primarily because of your structuralist inclinations. Could you sort of expand a bit upon that?
Yeah, it's a bit awkward. In some ways, I'm seen, probably wrongly, but in some ways I'm seen as a central figure in the English school, partly because I write a lot and make a lot of noise, and partly because I played a fairly conspicuous role in the sort of so-called late 1990s reconvening of the English school, getting it onto the agendas of the various ISAs around the place and all of that. So I'm prominent in that sense, and a few of the things that I've written have made some impact in the school debate, so I'm in that sense prominent too. But you know, I'm not part of any of the mainstream English school movements, as it were. I'm not, strictly speaking, you know, in the kind of White Watson comparative international history stuff, although I do a bit of that. I'm not in the kind of normative, you know, pluralist solidarist debate on normative grounds, although I'm also a little bit engaged in that. The move that I made, which I think does put me out on the margins, is to say, you know, if you look at the work of Hedley Bull and some of the other classical writers and focus in on this idea of primary institutions, that opens up a structural way of looking at international society and how it unfolds and progresses. Cal Holstein was the one who initially inspired me, so I owe him twice for this, because I saw the paper that ended up as his 2004 book, Taming the Sovereigns. So it just seemed to me that, you know, under the surface, in Bull in particular, but also other English school writers, there was a structural approach. It didn't require you to get particularly involved in the normative debates one way or the other, but was a way of setting up both comparative international society and also the evolution story of international society, what institution, institutions change and when and how, so that you could get a kind of process tracking and quite fine-grained view of international society, and also see how different institutions interact with each other. I was very struck, for example, James Mayall's 1990 book on nationalism. That's a great book in many ways. And he makes some really powerful points showing how, as nationalism became embedded as a new institution during the 19th century, it changed the meaning and practices of other institutions. So the point that struck me particularly was he said it sacralized territory. And that made a lot of sense to me in relation to the world history that I knew. I mean, Alsace-Lorraine, and all, not to mention the kind of ridiculous island disputes between Japan and China at the moment. You know, that's all about the sacralization of territory. It can have no other explanation. And that, you know, territory wasn't sacred like that before the 19th century. You could move bits around and nobody cared very much, as long as it was legitimate in terms of dynastic politics. So sort of showing how different packages of institutions contain different dynamics and different tensions and different complementarities, that all seemed to me a really insightful way of looking at the structure of international society, much more fine-grained than say, the Wentian scheme, which has English school roots anyway, which is cast in much more general terms.
But also hasn't been operationalized, right? I mean,
yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, Alex did a bit himself, but he's not had many takers to follow up, and he doesn't look like he's going to follow it up. So I guess this is my big English school hobby horse at the moment, is that I'm, again, ever the structuralist, fascinated by looking at this kind of high-altitude view of international societies. I'm not tremendously interested in normative debates, so international societies may be evolving in ways that make them nicer, or they may be evolving in ways that make them nastier, but my main interest is to work out how they're evolving and what the dynamics of that are. And that, I think, usefully feeds into the normative debates by sharpening them up and making them be clearer about their terms of reference and all that. So I have a few fans. It's early days yet, because I've only been out a few years. So I don't know whether it's going to take or not, but so far so good. And I'm still trying to work that stuff out myself.
Well, there certainly has been an uptick in English school work among younger non-British scholars. I mean, there's a couple of people who came out of Cornell, thinking about Andrew Phillips, for example, who's now down at, is he at ANU now? Do you know who I'm talking about? He had a book with Cambridge on religion and empire and international society.
No, in fact, I don't.
Oh, what was in the Cambridge series of international relations?
Send me an email and I'll put stuff in the bibliography.
I will definitely do that. But, you know, it's very embedded in an English school approach to comparative, to change dynamics.
There's an English school section at ISA now, which is entirely autonomous. I don't have to do anything. It seems to be going from strength to strength.
And there's been some interesting work on hegemony as an institution of international society within that framework. But also on the American side. See, this is the thing where I get myself into trouble because there are people I know well and then I forget their names on the spot. and so now we're on record where I'm like, But I think Barak Mendelsohn, another Cornell person, actually. And he had a book he's done work on the war on terror about the ways in which hegemony can both be a kind of institution of international society, but also if the hegemon starts to violate other norms, you know, it can create tensions and help explain why states do or don't cooperate with various kinds of counterterrorism measures. So,
I think this is really interesting stuff. I mean, for this book I mentioned, Introduction to the English School, I've just been looking into all of that. That debate about hegemony, hierarchy, and all of that has been there in the English School right from the beginning. There's some great lines from Adam Watson about this, because he and White, in the early days of the British Committee, way back in the 60s, they thought that the British Committee should be looking at international societies across quite a wide range, not just anarchic societies, but hegemonic ones and suzerain ones, and degrees of hierarchy were what interested them. But they didn't interest anybody else in the British Committee. So basically, the bull line on looking at international anarchies, which was more in tune with the American mainstream, because that's what realism and liberalism doing also, was focusing in on the anarchy problem. So the classical English school fitted in with that, but there were always dissident voices. And if you look at Watson's work, I mean, the whole thing is about, the pendulum theory. Hegemony is actually, the stablest point between the extremes of empire and anarchy and blah, blah, blah. That concern has been there for a long time, and it's been re-emerging of late with, and I think Ian Clark has picked up on this very well, the kind of tension between the fact that the notional organizing principle of the system is sovereign equality, but a great deal of the practice is hegemonic. I think there are some international lawyers like Gary Simpson. His 2004 book on great powers and outlaw states, strange title, a bit misleading. But that's a wonderful book from an international legal perspective, but one very much conscious of English school writing and thinking about the interplay between sovereign equality and what he calls legalized hegemony right since 1815. Mm-hmm. Wonderful book. So there's a lot of background stuff there, and it's come out recently in the work of Andy Hurl and others who kind of picked up this contradiction. And then Ian Clark has actually taken the bull by the horns and tried to work out the logics of hegemony as an institution. And he's made a terrific start on that.
I mean, it's interesting because, I've been trying to push the line in my very narrow corner of the world that one of the things that's happened with the quote-unquote new hierarchy studies is an opportunity for all these different groups to get into conversation with one another again. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because some of the things you've talked about I've heard of, but some of them I haven't, and it does seem like what I hadn't put it together with was the idea that, anarchy had been a focal point, back in the 60s and 70s, and now, for obvious reasons, we're thinking about hierarchy again, and hierarchy has become the element of these different theories that we're now trying to elaborate, which is really interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way.
Well, you could. Let's run with that for a little bit. In the sense, the anarchy side of things very much fitted in with the decolonization imperatives of the immediate post-Second World World. The hierarchy one, you might want to say, rather fits in with the imperatives of unipolarity and the need for somehow justifying an unequal order. So it, in a sense, not surprising that American IR theory would be thinking about this in the same way that American IR theory thought about bipolarity during the Cold War, because it addresses the American problem in this sense and is about where America is in the world and how it should locate itself in relation to the rest of international society, or the international system, if you prefer that way of thinking.
But if that's the driver, then we may be on the tail end of that, right? But the I do think that you're right. I mean, clearly the upswing in unipolarity, the rediscovery of hegemonic stability theory, order theory, power transition theory is probably being the, you know, or it's, well, rediscovery is the right word, its rise in prestige, right, after having been all but written off by some people in the early 90s. I mean, I remember going to grad school and being told hegemonic stability theory was a nice theory, but didn't really work. Now, of course, you know...
Details.
Right? You know,
as
but,
long as it's elegant.
Right. Of course, now, you know, sort of, we've had the return of hegemonic order theories of various stripes, unipolarity largely driven by the moment of 2002, 2003. Mm. But I think that what's interesting is the way that hierarchy work has now spilled over, right? Not just in terms of its backwards working components, but thinking about, okay, well, maybe we have kind of nested stratifications that matter a great deal in international society or international politics, whether it's the EU and its periphery and the ascension process during the 90s and the 2000s, whether it's, you know, what might the Asian system, you know, East Asian system look like, whether it's, you know, sort of whether you've got a kind of retreat. I do think that you're exactly right about why it is that the stuff gestated when it did, or became, you know, new again, because it's obviously all old stuff. but I do think what's interesting about it is that it's, I think it's got legs beyond just American hegemony. Hmm. At least I hope it does.
Yeah, it will anyway, because, one of my pet arguments at the moment is that, following on from the 19th century stuff, is that, you know, we're coming to the end of that transition into modernity, which created a huge power gap between those who commanded the revolutions of modernity and those who didn't. And that's what bred superpowers and all of that stuff. And as the rise of the rest really begins to bite, as it's doing now, that power gap is disappearing because the mode of power of modernity is available more and more widely, and more people are drawing on it. That, to me, points to what I've called a decentered world order, which will probably have a lot of regional characteristics to it, and to which the U.S. will have a deal of difficulty adjusting if that's the way it goes, because it kind of adapted itself to being the sole superpower for a very long time. And listen to the, if you can bear it, the rhetoric of American presidential campaigns. Nobody who's going to get elected to office is going to give up that line, because otherwise they won't get elected. So I think that's going to be an issue, and the hegemony issue is going to emerge, even if it fades away on the global level, it's going to emerge big time on some regional levels. China, for instance, Russia, even worse, India, they're all going to have those kinds of problems. Even to some extent, Germany is having those kinds of problems within the EU, which is the best institutionalized of all the regions in some way.
No, it's interesting because, you know, we, in your work with George, you talk about, you know, you sort of say we have to pay attention to the great divergence. And one of the things that Paul and I say in our, well, you know, our sort of, our response piece, quote unquote, is, well, you know, now we're entering the great convergence. So in a sense, you know, it's relative and relevant as background, but how relevant is it forward looking, right? And I think, you know, George, when he read the piece initially, said, well, I don't think we really disagree on anything, and it sounds like we don't. But this, I mean, I think that you're right. The if trajectories continue, the great convergence, as it were, the spread of modernity, or the even in its multiple form, right, the increasing availability of the tools and the infrastructure of what we think of as modernity throughout the world. The transition of emerging markets to now to complete markets, all those things are going to have enormous repercussions, not only in terms of regional denial capability, right? The U.S. will not be able to, in an unfettered manner, project power everywhere, you know, unless it moves to some sort of space-based dominance, which is part of the thinking right now, right? But also other states will start to develop some kinds of global strike capability, which will change that bargain a great deal or that relationship. And then we haven't even begun to think through what does this mean for international institutions, for economic orders, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we've sort of had this presumption in a lot of the literature coming out of the United States that, well, you know, basically everybody's just going to kind of get into the order.
Yeah.
At the same time that what the international political economy people are saying is that we're seeing a proliferation of regional institutions and a greater ability to forum shop, which implies a weakening of that order,
yeah,
precisely through these regionalization processes.
Yeah,
but you've done work on this.
I'm spending quite a bit of time in China at the moment, partly because the English school is a good sell there, and so is non-traditional security. So I'm trying to play into their debates about this kind of thing as well, and the Chinese school, so-called. But, I mean, going back to what you just said, I agree that in some ways, yes, there's a great convergence going on, although it seems to me that you have to look at this as both convergence and divergence. You mentioned multiple modernities, and I would very much kind of go along with that. Multiple modernity seems to me to be overdetermined if you look at that literature, not just out of economic logic, but cultural logics and all kinds of other things as well. So it's going to be multiple modernities. We're all going to be capitalists now, as you're suggesting, but we're going to be different kinds of capitalists, and that's going to create a certain amount of friction. But it seems to me there's going to be, and there already is, a pretty big ideological narrowing. I mean, during the 20th century, we killed each other in the tens of millions over the question of capitalism or not. That question is pretty much gone now, because it's merely a question of what kind of capitalist, which is a much less big divide in some senses. So
maybe, but to other people, right? You know, what was the Marxism capitalism? You know, it was a within civilization rivalry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Spread out, right? You know, in a sense, you could argue that this came out of a very narrow set of differences.
It was a rivalry within modernity,
yeah.
Sure. Which political ideology was going to dominate modernity?
But they're both ideologies that center on, you know, basic human equality, on presumptions about the productive capacity of capitalism, Marx's economics. As, you know, I mean, I don't want to go through the whole list. Marx's economics are very close to Ricardo and others, right? I mean, in a sense, you know, those may have seen, you know, from a macro historical perspective, those may turn out to seem small differences. Not all, you know, that may look like some of what we now think of, oh, those are going to be small differences about modes of capitalism.
We'll see. I mean, my feeling is that at the moment we are ripe for a big round of ideological humility. I mean, basically, everybody's ideology has bitten the dust. The Washington Consensus was the last one to go. So basically, we're now into a period where, you know, my feeling is, let the experiments in multiple modernities bloom and see what happens. I mean, which kind of capitalism is going to produce the most power, the most interesting culture, the most wealth, the most environmental sustainability, et cetera, et cetera. I'm kind of happy to let everybody have a go.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a winner will emerge, although I doubt it. It would seem to me that different cultures will want to go their different ways with different emphases, but that they will have enough being capitalists in some important basic sense gives them, back to international society again, gives them a pretty strong interest in maintaining rather major aspects of an international order, running a world economy together, because they know they're all screwed if they don't. So that seems to me, in some ways, I'm a bit optimistic about where we're heading, despite all of the present gloom. The kind of macro picture seems to me to be a better one than the one we've moved out of in the 20th century. There'll be lots of local problems along the way, some of them quite substantial, but we're out of the World War game, it seems to me, and into something else whose contours are now emerging.
Sonny, I was thinking, in some respects, you could argue that this is an extended riff on Robertson's work on globalization from the early 90s. You know, one of the first big works to explicitly theorize globalization, right? Where part of the process of the globalizing process is, the universalization of particularisms, the particularization of universalisms, and in what you call humility, right? That your grand universal schema run up against other universal schema, and they all kind of start to look not so universal anymore, which of course outrages a whole set of movements who are quite attached to the universality of their positions, and
yeah.
You wind
the,
up
the
with
the more ideological kind of liberal is not going to like this world.
Nor is the militant Islamist. So,
but the militant Islamists is not quite so set on universalism, I think, as the militant liberal, because Islam divides itself up into worlds that are Islam and worlds that are not. And so it's got a framework for dealing with that.
But if you think the ultimate goal is the expansion of the Ummah to the entire globe, then you... Which is,
but I don't think that's general to Islam.
No, I'm not. Militant is... I'm talking about a narrow slice. I've just been reading a bunch of stuff on Al-Qaeda ideology from the... Mm. For esoteric reasons that aren't worth going into because it's not something I study. Mm. And clearly some of that's there.
Strange bedtime reading that.
this is terrific. So we've ended, we've had some very, I think, really interesting insights from you about kind of how to think about where we're headed globally. And I've heard you talk about this before, and it's great stuff. And, I hope it sounds like more of it's coming out for us to all read. But the other thing that I think would be useful to kind of maybe close a little bit on is where you see the state of the discipline, right? We've already mentioned in passing transatlantic, trans-Pacific divides. Some of your own account talks about various kinds of convergence and divergence as IR becomes more of a global discipline. Mm-hmm. I was wondering how things look to you now, looking back on the last 20, 30 more years of working in this field and being somebody who's set a lot of agendas in this field?
I suppose the best way into that is to talk about the project I did with Amitav Acharya on why is there no non-Western IR theory. And that started 6 or 7 years ago now. And that's actually, it was intended as a provocation, in particular to India and China, but also to other places, is to sort of, hey, guys, if you think we've got all the answers, then fine. But if you think you have something to say, then kindly get your voice into the game, because it seemed to me that there were some places where there was an eagerness to do this, in China most particularly. But in other places, they were beginning to get fidgety under the hegemony of American IR theory. Places like Japan and Korea were beginning to see the limits of it, and beginning to see also that this was, in a sense, Western theory, because if you think about it, most Western IR theory is simply derivative of Western history. So if you ask yourself the question, what would international relations look like if it had been invented in China, the answer would be pretty much not at all what it looks like now. International relations is coming to being on the basis of a very particular history. The first thing we need to do is get other histories into play and other kinds of concepts. I mean, the Chinese, I think, rightly complain that you cannot really think about the Sinocentric international society in East Asia that lasted nearly two millennia using the concepts of Western IR theory. Suzerainty might come a bit close, but it not really what's going on there. That suzerainty in the Western sense implies more of a kind of political-military relationship, whereas suzerainty in the Chinese context is a more cultural one. So it's got a different kind of content and context, and might well then begin to generate additional concepts into the existing Western taxonomies. So I'm expecting that as the Chinese and the Indians and others, and the Indians are just having their very first Indian Association of International Studies conference next month. Big move. I'm going to go and give a plenary talk to it. Those kinds of moves are underway, and I think IR globally will benefit from this a lot. I don't particularly worry about fragmentation of the discipline. It's covering a big subject. There are going to be lots of different theoretical approaches to it, which will be good for different things. Good for some things and not good for others. It seems to me that it's still very lively. It's still very popular. It's not going to go out of relevance for sure, no matter which of our future scenarios comes about. It seems to me IR is going to remain highly relevant and highly popular, and I look forward to getting other than Western voices in the debate in a big way. And so we get some cultural fusions going on in both directions in IR, because it's too much one-way traffic.
All right. Well, that's a terrific place to end it. You've generously given a lot of your time. I'm looking at the recording length right now.
How's your battery doing?
The battery's doing okay. We're still above 50%, so that's not a concern. But thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I really appreciate it.
Pretty good.
Thus endeth episode number 15 of the Duck of Minerva podcast. This interview with Barry Buzan was recorded on November 12th, 2012. I hope you enjoyed it. So long.